This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
Good morning. It's Friday, June the 24th, 2022. Welcome to Now with Dave Brown, coming to you on AMI Audio and AMI TV. I'm Dave Brown. Let's hit the horns and go. Happy Saint Jean Baptiste Day to you if you're choosing to celebrate. Coming up on the show today, we have our weekly news panel with Michelle McQuigg and Joita Gupta. Today we discuss the federal government's decision to freeze Hockey Canada's funding amid a sexual misconduct scandal. Elections Canada has revealed thousands of mail, and BC Premier John Horgan has decided to pause a multi-million dollar plan to replace the Provincial Museum in Victoria. We'll share our thoughts on that one. In the second hour of the show, entertainment critic Michael McNeely reviews the 2021 film Wildhood. And AMI communications specialist Greg David will give you the scoop and look ahead to AMI TV's summer programming. But let's begin the show with our top story of the day. Prince Charles opened the 26th meeting of Commonwealth leaders by urging them to learn from mistakes of the past.
In Canada recently, my wife and I were deeply touched to meet many of those engaged in the ongoing process of reconciliation. Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples reflecting honestly and openly on one of the darkest aspects of history. As challenging as that conversation can be, people across Canada are approaching it with courage and unwavering commitment.
Charles made clear that each Commonwealth nation's relationship to the Crown is for them to discern, opening the door for countries to sever ties if they choose. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau discussed a number of issues that Canada will address at the meeting of Commonwealth leaders.
From climate change to the outcomes of the pandemic, but also the destabilization that Russia's illegal and illegitimate war in Ukraine is causing on economies, on supply chains, inflationary pressures both at home and around the world, but also pressures on fuel and specifically on food.
The Prime Minister focused further on food insecurity.
Since the beginning of the year, Canada's invested about $500 million in aid for the World Food Programme, for UNICEF, for other UN agencies to try and counter this food crisis that is entirely caused by Russia's illegal and illegitimate actions. And I'm happy to announce an additional $250 million that Canada is going to be putting forward towards the UN, towards the World Food Programme.
Coming back to Canada, the Vatican has released the program for Pope Francis's trip to Canada next month, which includes visiting the site of a former Alberta residential school in Muskwitches. Gilda Susse is part of the church committee preparing for that visit. Susse feels the visit will allow survivors to speak their truths and healing may begin.
It's a step forward to the path of healing for the Indigenous people. You know, for myself as an intergenerational trauma survivor, it's hopeful.
The Pope will also be speaking with members of the parish community of Sacred Heart Church of First Peoples in Edmonton. Fernie Marty is an elder at that church.
We have a unique history happening here, and it's important for myself, for my own personal healing to continue. I'm grateful that the Pope has chosen to Sacred Heart to come and visit here, and I'm really excited and nervous to meet with this individual.
The Pope is also slated to conduct a mass at Commonwealth Stadium, a mass, if you will. Let's go for one more news story here. We're always talking about travel delays here in Canada, and there's lots of stories about overnight campouts in Montreal waiting for passports. Well, let's look abroad to Europe, where flight delays and cancellations across Europe are being blamed on severe staffing shortages at airports. Where have you heard that before? Tom Rivers files this report.
Air travel in 2022, long airport lines, lost luggage piling up. After 2 years of restrictions, travel demand has roared back. But airlines and airports that slash jobs are struggling to keep up. Hank Ambale from the aviation consultancy firm Cirium.
It takes quite a long time for airlines and airports to recruit, train, and get security clearance for their staff. So it'll be a few months before the main crunch points are over.
Nearly 2,000 flights from major European airports were canceled during just 1 week this month. Tom Rivers, ABC News at the Foreign Desk.
After simply traveling interprovincially this week, I don't think I'm going to fly internationally ever again. I'm just going to be living in Canada, or when it's time to travel abroad, I'm going to take a boat. I'm just going to take boats places. I'm going old school. Let's get to our daily polls. At AMI Audio is where you find us on Twitter. Accessible Media Inc. is where you find us on Facebook. Yesterday, we asked you a question about travel. What are the best and hardest parts of returning home after a trip? Andrika writes in, best part is sleeping in my own bed and eating home-cooked food. Hardest part is going back to work. I always need to book an extra day or two before returning so I can adjust my sleep and wake-up times. I agree with Andrika on that one wholeheartedly. Luca tweets, definitely making a nice cooked meal, though unpacking in a suitcase can be annoying. Usually the open suitcase turns into a makeshift drawer over the next couple of weeks. Yeah, I had that moment yesterday too as I took out a bunch of my laundry and threw it in the machine. I thought to myself, how long can I leave this suitcase open on my living room floor? In the end, it got scurried off into the guest room closet where it belongs because we need order for society to work. Today's Daily Poll at AMI Audio on Twitter, Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook. As I mentioned right off the top of the show, it is Saint Jean Baptiste Day, which will be celebrated extensively in Quebec and maybe in a couple francophone communities across the country as well. And maybe our friends in Louisiana might get down a little bit as well. I'm asking you, do you celebrate holidays that you may not have a cultural connection to? Yes, no, or it depends on the holiday. Again, I'm a Anglophone Quebecer, but I used to enjoy myself a little Saint Jean. There used to be free concerts and fireworks and all kinds of good stuff around Montreal, although it's not necessarily a holiday that I miss now that I don't live in Montreal. But I'll tell you, if I could walk into the beer store and buy a nice six-pack of Boreal or La Belle Gueule, I wouldn't mind a little taste of home. Let's bring in Grace Schofield. If you don't have a cultural connection to a holiday, would you still celebrate?
I think it depends on what the holiday is. So, like, I'm not Irish, but for St. Patrick's Day, I will go all out.
Yeah, heck
green
yeah.
Beer, green wings, like all of the things.
Ooh,
I want
wings.
All of the green things. But, you know, I think it kind of depends on which holiday it is. I, for one, I love to celebrate things. I love to decorate for things. I'm a big person like that. I like to do all those sorts of things. You know, I'm off to the dollar store for every holiday, just like stuffing the cart full of like streamers and things that I'm never going to use again. I'm like terrible for the environment, but I use a metal straw, so it's fine. But yeah, I think it definitely depends on the holiday. But if you can have some fun with it and it's not, you know, you're not appropriating anything, I think that's a good way you can celebrate, and I think it's fine.
It didn't show up on camera, but I just vigorously pointed it at you as you mentioned cultural appropriation, because I do think there is an important note to make there about, hey, you can celebrate a holiday and you can do it respectfully, but
yes,
like maybe just don't like suck down a poutine today and post it on social media and be like, I ate a poutine, look at me, happy
right?
Saint Jean.
Yeah.
Or like, I had a Pepsi and a Mae West, look at me, I'm all down with French culture. So yeah, 100%. I think that we need to be very sensitive in the way that we do it, but I think there's nothing wrong with getting a little bit enthusiastic about a good holiday.
Exactly.
You know, my mom used to tell me a story about a university professor they had, that if the class could come in and show him that there was a stat holiday or a significant cultural holiday that day, he would give them the day off class. So it had them do a little bit of like world history research, and then they got a day off class and they could go to the bear.
I would love that, because that's one of the things I don't understand about post-secondary school is that holidays mean nothing to them. Like, I've been in class through every holiday for the past few years, and I'm like, I don't understand. Just give me this one Monday, please. I just need this one week.
You know what used to blow me away about university time off is that the winter vacation was so, so short. When I was in CEGEP, which is sort of junior college in Quebec, they used to give you a month. When I was at Algonquin College in Ontario, they gave you a month. But the university break, it's like, last exam, December 23rd, back of class, January 2nd.
So because I'm in the program I'm in, I don't usually have any exams. So for me, my winter break is like 6 weeks.
Look at Grace beating the system.
Right? I'm cool like that. But for some of my other friends, they're like, I have a week and a half.
Yeah, it's
like
brutal.
They're off from Christmas to New Year's and they're right back into it.
Yeah, it's brutal.
And I feel really bad for them. But me, I chill for 6 weeks. I hang out.
Grace knows how to live. Let's bring in Mike Ross. Mike, if you do not have a cultural connection to a holiday, are you still inclined to celebrate?
Okay, so do I go out of my way to celebrate it on my own? Probably not.
But I have been invited to celebrations where I have gone and really enjoyed the celebration. So, for example, I've been to many Jewish celebrations. Mm-hmm. I've been to some Persian celebrations, Persian New Year celebration, and really enjoyed it. So, yeah, I'm not one to go and necessarily grab another's culture and say, oh, I'm taking this day and making it mine. But when I'm invited to experience that community, I've had a great time.
Yeah, I love getting invited to a cultural celebration. I've had the opportunity to be at a couple Passover Seders over the years and a couple Hanukkah celebrations as well, which I always really enjoy. I like the ones where I don't have to fast as part of it. Like, just bring me to the mm-hmm. feast and I'll take part in that good side of it. Hey, Mike, thank you for this.
You got it.
That's Mike Ross. We'll talk to him a little bit later in the show. In the meantime, you can talk to us at AMI Audio on Twitter, Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook, and you can listen to Grace Schofield as she gives you the national weather updates.
Thanks, Dave. Here we go. We'll start off in St. John's, Newfoundland, where it is cloudy with a 40% chance of showers or drizzle early this morning, then a mix of sun and cloud and a high of 25 degrees. In Halifax, there's periods of rain ending early this afternoon, then mainly cloudy with 30% chance of showers and a high of 19 degrees. In Montreal, it's cloudy today, clearing near noon and a high of 27. In Ottawa, it's clearing up this morning and a high of 28 degrees. In Toronto, it will be sunny today with a high of 28 degrees. Over to Thunder Bay, Ontario, where it's mainly cloudy today, with a high of 24 degrees. In Winnipeg, Manitoba, it's mainly cloudy, with a 70% chance of showers or thunderstorms this afternoon, and a high of 28 degrees. In Saskatoon, a mix of sun and cloud, with a risk of a thunderstorm late this afternoon, and a high of 18 degrees. In Calgary, Alberta, showers ending this afternoon, then cloudy with 60% chance of showers, and a high of 15 degrees. In Edmonton, Alberta, cloudy with a 30% chance of showers early this morning, then a mix of sun and cloud and a high of 18 degrees. Up in Yellowknife, Northwest Territories, a mix of sun and cloud with a risk of a thunderstorm late this afternoon and a high of 21 degrees. In Vancouver, BC, it's sunny today with a high of 22 degrees and some matching weather in Victoria, BC, where it is also sunny with a high of 22 degrees. And that was your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
Thank you very much, Grace. Coming up after the break, it's news panel time. Michelle and Joita will be here, and we will talk about the federal government's decision to freeze Hockey Canada's funding amidst a sexual assault scandal. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. It is news panel time. Let's bring back into the show Joita Gupta and Michelle McQuigg. Hey, good morning, Joita.
Good morning, Dave.
And good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Dave.
Let's jump right into our first story, guys. The federal government has frozen Hockey Canada's funding, effective immediately. Minister of Sport Pascal Saint-Ange made the announcement in response to the organization's handling of a sexual assault scandal and settlement. Saint-Ange said Hockey Canada will only have funding restored once it discloses recommendations contained in an incomplete report by a third-party law firm hired to investigate an alleged group sex incident. Hockey Canada must also become a signatory to the Officer of the Integrity Commissioner, a new government agency with the power to independently investigate abuse complaints and levy sanctions. And just a little more context, this stems from several members of the unnamed members of the 2018 World Junior Squad who engaged in non-consensual group sex in a hotel room after a Hockey Canada golf tournament one summer. Joita, this is your topic. Why did you want us to go a little bit deeper?
I think it's a topic that's been making waves and has been just about in every major publication in the last week. I feel like it really has been a story that has churned to the surface many of the systemic issues that plague professional hockey, the culture of masculinity, and whether the many efforts made over the decades to address sexual assault in hockey have actually come to fruition. And of course, you've got the federal government there now, inclined to now deciding to freeze their funding to Hockey Canada. What is the impact of that going to be? Is it really going to make a difference? And, you know, could Hockey Canada do more to deal with situations like this when and if they come up? Are you happy with the way that this was handled? Are you dissatisfied with how it went? There's so many interesting questions to talk about, but all of this is happening in the backdrop of many concerned voices where people are saying, look, no one's really surprised or shocked that something like this has gone down. We have to address some of the systemic problems that plague professional hockey. So what is the way forward? I think that is the ultimate question.
The choice to go right after the money and freeze that funding makes sense to me, especially with the strings attached. Michelle, what do you think?
I agree, although I question aspects of the impact of the financial freeze specifically, although I think ultimately it will all come down to the same thing. So one thing that's really jumped out at me through all this is how much money Hockey Canada has. They got $14 million worth of federal funding, some documents have shown, and that is about sixth in terms of their revenue streams. They get a whole lot more from partnerships and advertising and a whole lot of other stuff, which doesn't stand to be affected by this. But I do think that freezing the funding and forcing them to sign on to things like the Office of the Integrity Commissioner and a few other, some of the other two, you know, mechanisms that are in place here, to say nothing of all the publicity that Joita mentioned, I think that's where the impact will really be felt. Obviously, $14 million is not small change, even if it is sixth in their revenue stream. But this has really been shining a light on this and forcing some scrutiny and forcing more active conversation. And I think that's where the real benefit will be. This is a situation that has lots of tendrils. This day happened at the World Juniors, of course, or with the World Junior team from some years ago, but some of those players are now in the NHL. Even though we don't know who they are, we know that much. So this is an issue that has extreme reach, extreme impact, is close to the heart of a lot of Canadians, and I think by forcing it into the limelight like this, on top of the financial penalties, I think that's where the benefit of the government's actions will really come through.
Yeah, Michelle, I'm glad you mentioned the financial streams that exist there, the $14 million only being sixth in the amount of money they received. Hockey Canada took a lot of COVID funding from the federal government as well. So if we can say that the money doesn't really affect them, then why were they taking all that COVID funding? But that could be a totally different issue about who was getting some of this money in this economic recovery. And I don't want to dismiss the importance of this topic. Joita, what do you make of the decision from the federal government?
I think in a lot of ways the federal government had to do something. When the story broke on TSN, it would have been deeply problematic for the federal government to have done nothing. And so even though the financial impact of freezing the funds may not be felt by Hockey Canada to the same extent as, you know, some other institutions or agencies, it's still making a statement. The fact that Hockey Canada has been required to make public the recommendations of the report, as yet unpublished, that's going to be a really important step forward as well. I think by withholding by freezing their funding, it is a way to ensure that those recommendations at minimum see the light of day. And the fact that they might be asked to sign on with the Office of the Integrity Commissioner means that at least in future, there may be some kind of an accountability mechanism. But I agree with Michelle. I think the real impact here is that this has become a widely publicized public issue. I think the reputational damage to Hockey Canada may far exceed any financial penalty. And yet there is, in some respects, more that the federal government could do, and maybe we'll see some announcements about this down the road. For example, I know there are people who sort of scoff at, oh, not another public inquiry. But, you know, given that there are many voices who have said this is a longstanding systemic issue, maybe the federal government could think about calling a public inquiry, not just to look at this incident, but sort of some of the broader structural and systemic issues that might facilitate abuse and predation and violence against women in hockey. And what a public inquiry allows you to do is subpoena things and really go deep into the issues. Whether, you know, you'll actually see recommendations from the public inquiry further implemented, well, now we're just speculating. But that is something that the federal government could do down the road. Unfortunately, in this situation, because the incident took place in Ontario, they couldn't, for example, get the RCMP involved, nor could they lay criminal charges. So there are also a lot of things that they couldn't do under the circumstances. Really, they've done the bare minimum that they could. The financial penalties, I think, was almost expected, because it's not like the federal government in the situation could have really gotten away with doing nothing, especially when questions are surfacing about whether public dollars were used to settle the lawsuit with the woman. She asked for $3.55 million, but we don't know what the settlement amount actually was, and there's a non-disclosure agreement that she had to sign. So again, there are questions swirling about whether, you know, tax dollars went into paying off this woman as well.
It was particularly embarrassing when Hockey Canada's top brass was testifying this week in front of federal politicians and really didn't have their facts in a row. The investigation is incomplete. Only six players participated in the voluntary investigation that went on here. Six of 24 players, by the way. The facts weren't straight. The investigation was woeful. Michelle, what do you think they could have done better? I mean, I would say right away, you have to make testifications or this investigation compulsory. You must participate if you were part of this team or at this tournament.
I mean, that's certainly something I would want to see as well. I should clarify that, yeah, we heard the number six initially, which was jaw-dropping, and then later on, but this kind of speaks to your point as well, some of the Hockey Canada officials, the leader said, oh, sorry, our bad, it was more like 13, which is still only about half of the number of people that were there.
But 13 when they weren't under oath. It was 13 to the media. It was six when they were under oath.
Fair enough. Yeah. No, I mean, and this is part of it, right? Like we there were no clear answers. That was the justification, or part of the justification that Saint-Ange used when she decided to freeze this funding, is the fact that answers were not forthcoming. Yeah, mandatory testimony, I think, is going to be important, although it might be difficult to pull off. Just in light, I'm thinking of, you know, mechanisms in place for things like the Special Investigations Unit for police and investigating police complaints. A lot of that stuff is not mandatory either. So maybe there are rules in place that would hamper that effort, but I do think there would be a whole lot more onus on players to cooperate and be forthcoming. Some internal process would be necessary, but one complicating factor here is that they did enlist a third-party outfit to conduct this investigation. Maybe you need to have better rules on who can conduct that and how those are conducted. Obviously, an internal process would not calm any waves here. Disclosing documentation, disclosing results of the investigation, I think would be a big one. That's another one where we don't have a lot of answers. We don't even know how much a settlement was for at this point. So increasing transparency all around, I think, would start to address some of these concerns.
Yeah.
Start.
In the end, you may not be able to find a resolution in this particular case because the settlement's already been reached. But this is an example. This could set an example and a template for what you want to do moving forward, or what should be done moving forward.
Exactly. And it's worth pointing out that they've indicated they had three such cases before them in the recent years. We've only really heard about the one. So obviously, this is a systemic issue that needs to be addressed more broadly.
Joita, what do you think could be done to make for a better investigative process if Hockey Canada does not want to sign on to these federal regulations or federal restrictions or federal strings?
Well, the first thing that I would say is that this really should have been a criminal matter, and it should have been dealt with through the criminal courts. Unfortunately, and this is not surprising, the victim in this case chose not to go to the police and did not want to go through the legal process. I know I've said this before, and others have made the point as well, that the legal system can often feel like a second rape for women. So there's a bigger issue there about why matters that rightly ought to be dealt with through the criminal process do not get dealt with in that way. I think I was reading a column in the Globe and Mail yesterday by Greg Mason, who basically called the whole thing a cover-up, that the whole thing smells of a cover-up, where the whole impetus behind this investigation and the desire to keep things under wraps and keep things secretive was to protect the reputation of Hockey Canada, to protect the reputation of the sports, and most importantly, to protect the privacy and reputation of the players and to make sure that their careers weren't jeopardized in any way. Because that report, which was conducted by, as Michelle mentioned, a third-party law firm, which is headed up by Marie Hanin, who you might recognize was Gian Gomeshi's lawyer, not that that means anything, but you know, that report is still to be made public. None of the names have been made public, so we don't actually know who was in the room. There's no way to hold anybody accountable. And just out of idle curiosity, I was going over the list of the 2018 World Junior Hockey Team to see if were all of these if were all of these fellows under the age of 18, because that would sort of justify a ban on their names. But no, they're all, as far as I can see, most of them were 20. There was a 19-year-old. Certainly when the incident took place, most of them appear to have been over the age of 18. So it really is baffling to me why nobody's names were made public. Moreover, I do agree about the point, about the fact that these, that the decision to cooperate with the committee was entirely voluntary, which is really surprising. Now, mind you, I haven't played professional hockey. Maybe the two of you have, but the little bit I know.
I was this close, Chuita. I was this close.
You're hilarious, yeah. Truly.
But you know what? The little I've gathered from secondhand knowledge is that everything to do with professional hockey of any kind is highly regimented. What you eat in the morning, the uniform you wear, the pads that you use, the number of push-ups you do—all of those things are mandatory. Why is it that every aspect of this game and training for the game is mandatory except participating on a really important committee? So that's, again, a really baffling, and it kind of ties back to that, the point that I was making about how the investigation process really appears to have been more of an effort to cover up rather than a genuine attempt to try and get to the bottom of what happened here.
Mm. This story, unfortunately, is not uncommon. It comes on the heels of the Kyle Beach Chicago Blackhawks sexual assault situation that became publicly also reported by TSN's Rick Westhead in the fall of last year. I think we talked about that story on this news panel. We've talked about the USA Gymnastics scandal on this panel. I've spoken extensively about violence against women in relation to the NFL, Ben Roethlisberger, Ray Rice, even right now Deshaun Watson of the Cleveland Browns continuing to be in the headlines, with 24 civil suits for alleged sexual misconduct, and the New York Times reporting at least 40 more cases that are unsettled, including some in the building of the Houston Texans. There are structural issues that exist inside professional and amateur sports when it comes to sexual assault. Michelle, does this story suggest anything different to you about where we're at despite the conversations that we've had for the last decade or so?
Not as much as we'd like to see, but I am a little bit heartened, I think, by the amount of scrutiny and discussion that it's received. Yes, it continues the trend we've just talked about. Having these conversations is no longer new, but now we are starting to see some action attached to this. I can't honestly imagine the federal government yanking funding 10 years ago. Now that's happened. I think it's a matter of starting to set some new precedents, and if they get Hockey Canada signed up to some of these other mechanisms that were ostensibly anyway supposed to offer some additional safeguards, I think that can only be progress. I think what's emerging here in Canada specifically is a growing complexity around the picture involving violence and toxicity in amateur sport. Boxing Canada has another really interesting scandal going on too. I won't get into it all now, but that's another one where workplace culture is really being attacked on a pretty direct level with some pretty strong accusations. So it is interesting to me to see that we're starting to move past the conversation point. Obviously, there's a whole lot more that needs to be done. But the very fact that some actions are being taken, even if I think we've all reached a consensus that perhaps not enough, but the fact that this new phase has begun, I think, is an encouraging sign. That's about as far as I'll go.
Juita, along those lines, even though we've had certainly some strong conversations over the course of the last decade, we're still seeing these incidents. Where does it leave the overall picture and landscape of sexual misconduct in sports?
Well, speaking specifically that, you know, just if you look at some of the comments made by Sheldon Kennedy, for example, at least as far as hockey is concerned, Sheldon Kennedy says that not very much has changed over the decades. And that's a really powerful thing to say, because there is a culture in, at least in junior hockey, for example, where, you know, kids are taken away, teenagers are taken away from their parents, they live with billeted families, they get a lot of social power. It's a sort of an alcohol-fueled culture. And there is this whole culture of sexualized hazing. I don't know if all of that has really undergone significant change. And the reason I say it hasn't, it doesn't feel like it's undergone significant change, is because, and I wish I could remember where I read this, but someone really broke it down extremely well. And they said, you know, the way that the woman was there was one player who bought her several drinks. He then took her to his room. She left with one person, but then he invited his friends to join. And that's not just an accident. That was a strategy. And later on, they made her take a video in which she claimed that she was sober. And that's not just, you know, a random act. That's alibi creation. Yeah. Then they made her take a shower on her way out. And that's a way to reduce the amount of available evidence for a rape kit. And that's predation. And so what the point that was being made is that this has happened. This isn't a one-off. This has happened before. And unless something really changes, it may, I am sad to say, happen again. And so you don't just need high-level conversations. You need conversations at the grassroots. There's a lot of young men who entertain dreams of playing in the NHL. Hockey has a really special place in the hearts of many Canadians. And there are hundreds of thousands of young Canadians who get involved in some kind of organized sports across this country. This issue requires far more attention than it's been getting. I feel like we've been going in circles, having the same conversation over and over again. Whether we've reached a tipping point or whether we've truly turned a corner, I am not convinced that enough has been done in this instance. There is so much that is unknown in this particular instance, and the federal government's moves, although welcome, are frankly pro forma. So I am waiting to see what changes and whether we would be in the truly unfortunate situation 3 years, 5 years, 10 years down the line, where we end up inevitably having the same conversation all over again.
The one thing that hockey could take a lesson from is the world of basketball, where women are becoming way more prevalent, not just at the elite level of the sport, but all throughout the sport in regard to coaching young men. It showed last night in the NBA draft, two of the guys taken in the top five were the sons of high-level women's basketball coaches. We're seeing a much stronger integration of women into the coaching structures and managerial structures of that sport at the grassroots and elite levels. It makes a big difference. We have not seen that in hockey. We're starting to see it a little bit with NHL teams bringing in top-level female coaches and development coaches, but it's not happening at the grassroots, and that's something that hockey should be taking a very close look at the way that basketball is seeing this, because frankly, we just don't see these kinds of stories out of the basketball world. Okay, that's it. We have
great
to move
point.
On. Coming up next, we chat about an Elections Canada report that reveals thousands of mail-in ballots were not counted during the federal election. This is the Now News Panel on AMI. Welcome back. It's the Now News Panel on AMI. I'm Dave Brown, joined by Michelle McQuigg and Joey DeGupta. Let's address our next topic. Almost 100,000 mail-in ballots were not counted in the federal election last year. A new report from Elections Canada has revealed 99,988 special ballots were, quote, set aside and not counted because they arrived too late, were not filled in properly, or lacked a signature. The Elections Canada analysis found an 82% increase in the number of mail-in ballots in last year's election compared to 2019. The report said more than 1.1 million special ballots were received. So as I mentioned there, in most cases, it was a user error or missing a deadline. Even still, that's nearly 10% of the 1.1 million special ballots that went out. That's a lot. Michelle, do you find that number concerning?
Especially at a time when we are struggling to deal with low civic engagement more generally, right? We had bad voter turnout for the federal election last year. We had a horrible voter turnout in the Ontario election. We know that special balloting is one potential mechanism, not necessarily one that's widely used, but one that I think a lot of people would be interested in making use of. The spike alone last year is interesting and speaks to me of the demand. Obviously, COVID exacerbated that, but I think it speaks to more of a pent-up demand. If that many of your ballots are going astray or not able to be counted, especially in the kind of system we have right now, when we frequently see parties assuming power without the benefit of the popular vote, that is really concerning to me. I don't think it's going to do a whole lot to bolster civic engagement. I don't think it's going to do a whole lot to further instill confidence in our electoral system. Obviously, there are many cries for reform, and this might be part of it, but I don't see a good side to this at all. I do find it very concerning, and it certainly raises a lot of questions about alternate ways to proceed.
Joita, even considering that part of this was indeed user error, do you find the idea that 10%, nearly 10% of special ballots were cast aside, do you find that concerning?
I do. I absolutely do. I note that a number, that was a large spike, as you indicated, Dave, just because more people were requesting the special ballots, largely owing to COVID-19. One of the things that I don't know, and maybe Michelle can shed some light on this, is whether the 10% is uniform across previous elections. So in 2019, for example, during the federal elections, were 10% of the votes cast aside? Is the 10% because of, the spike in the numbers of people and errors made and some of the complications brought about due to COVID? Or, do 10% of these ballots routinely get lost and or set aside? You know, that it does change the picture considerably if you stop to think about it. The number in and of itself is very shocking. I'll grant you that.
I'll answer your question, Joita. I think it's a good question, but no, I don't know the answer as to whether or not that's a static figure that sort of gets relatively consistent from year to year. But I don't know that answer, but it is a good question.
I didn't have that number either.
I couldn't find it. And the other thing that I'm curious about, and I think you'll agree that this is an important question, is what kind of an impact would it have actually had on the federal election? Granted, we ended up with what we started out with, but at least in a close riding or in a close race, it might have made a difference to count those votes and include them. But whether it would have made a huge difference to the outcome of the election itself, I do not know because nobody's done a study on that. So with all of those unknowns in place, there are still a number of things that do jump out as red flags that do concern me about this whole issue.
I would say anecdotally, just the mail delay issues. We know Canada Post has been banged up a lot, and we know that a lot of other, because a lot of these mail-in ballots that would be special ballots involve foreign postal services. I do imagine that COVID probably caused a bit of an increase there, but that's more of an instinctual, anecdotal piece of evidence rather than necessarily hard evidence.
I'm sure you're right, Dave. The other thing I will add to this is I don't know if we're going to be able to get those numbers. Elections Canada has saying that this has been one of the first times that they've disclosed this much detail about the special balloting process. So the fact that we don't have the numbers, maybe that's because it simply wasn't disclosed before.
Yeah.
I hope this leads to a trend of additional reporting and a little more bit more of a window into that process, because it is an interesting one.
As usual, Michelle and Dave are all about raw data because we're nerds.
Yes, we certainly are.
Now, again, I do want to come back to user error, because Elections Canada did indicate that a lot of this was user error. The ballot filled out improperly, whether that was an intentional spoiling, which does happen, or whether that was a matter of somebody not doing their signature properly on the ballot. Guys, this question is super, super obvious, so please, let's not go too long on it. But is, once again, even considering the user error side, but should there be super duper clear instructions on how someone should execute a special ballot, Joita? I don't mean like make sure all the fine print's there. I mean like big print, step 1, 2, 3. Here's what you have to do. Super duper plain language, clear.
Well, here's the thing. I haven't actually ever voted by special ballot myself, so I haven't seen the instructions that are on the ballot right now. So I don't know if they're super duper clear, because they might already be. There is an undeniable fact. Sometimes people just don't read instructions, no matter how clear they are. It's a fact of life. Yeah. With that said, I'm certainly quite happy to and I welcome any suggestions that make instructions clearer and make them available in plain language, especially as someone who cares about disability issues and encouraging civic engagement in disability issues. Large print, so important for low vision voters. Also plain language, really important for anyone with any kind of a cognitive disability. So no complaints there. The one thing that was a little strange to me was this need to have ballots arrive by 6 p.m. on election day in order to be counted. That one really struck me as a bit weird, because you could really just have a situation where you postmark it as being, for election day, and then you maybe give them 10 days down the road to allow voters to submit to submit their to mail it in on election days and give them maybe 10 days to allow those ballots to arrive. So that besides the user error issues was the other thing that kind of really jumped out as me as being a little bit peculiar.
So I also can't speak to what the direct instructions on the special ballot were, but I will say simply going to the website and trying to request a special ballot was not a straightforward process. There were a lot of different windows. There were a lot of different dropdowns. It was quite an extensively not super duper easy process. So my instinct, once again, it's instinct, would suggest that the ballot that arrived had a ton of small print on it and a lot of instructions rather than just clear instructions. Michelle, again, for the sake of time here, brevity, because we want to get to a lot of talk on the last topic today, but super duper clear instructions on special ballots?
Absolutely. For a lot of the same reasons Joita mentioned, those with intellectual disabilities or communication-related disabilities could really, really benefit from plain language, from maybe some illustrations if need be. So not only super clear instructions, but perhaps fewer steps, right? When you cast a ballot in person, there's only so much you really need to do. If you were to finally streamline the process of casting a special ballot, that might go some way to alleviating some of this. And of course, there's the elephant in the room of online voting, mm-hmm. which is a whole other thing.
Yeah, let's go there. Realistically, Michelle, how long till we can just get on with online voting already?
I don't know. We've been seeing it in some municipalities in Canada. It's never been rolled out more broadly. I think there might have been one provincial election where it was used, but don't even quote me on that because I'm not positive. I have no idea, and I wish I understood more of where the holdup lay.
Yeah, I'm in that frustrated, exacerbated category too. Like, can we just get on with this, Joita? What do you think? Online voting, it's time.
I don't know if you saw the visual. I was like, while you guys were talking, I was shaking my head because I can understand the temptation to go with online voting. As people with disabilities, it's convenient. It's often more accessible. But come on, guys, you can't hack paper ballots. There will always be, no matter how secure you make the system, an assumption or a presumption that the voting isn't secure, that someone's hacked it. You know, people will not be able to trust the results. And
people can hack paper ballots, though.
But not to the same extent. And really, we have mechanisms in place to ensure accountability and scrutineering and all kinds of other things in place just to make sure that paper ballots are more secure. I'm not convinced that we should be so quick to jump on the online voting bandwagon because it really will undermine the integrity of our election process. It's tempting, I'll grant you that, but honestly, just from the point of view of, there's a great anecdote in the article that you sent around, Dave, where there was that one person who was flying in a helicopter and getting ballots from people in lighthouses. Let's not assume that everybody has the ability to vote online. Not everybody has access to an internet.
Oh, I'm not saying exclusive, Joita. We're not arguing exclusive. We're saying it needs to be an option.
No, I don't agree with it at all. I think this is, one of those measures that seems really glossy and on the surface and seems like it'll be a good idea, but it will backfire on us in spectacular fashion. And honestly, if people have trouble figuring out paper ballots, can you imagine the confusion with filling out an online ballot? Where is my ID? Where is my password? How do I do this? It's a really bad idea.
We got to revisit this one.
Yeah, we should revisit this because I will also say there's a lot of charm with having senior citizens counting paper ballots at the end of a 12-hour workday. At polling stations. And I will say every time I slide my Ontario election ballot into one of those machines, I'm like, this doesn't seem super scrutineerable. Because that's it in Ontario now. Like, it's not, you slide your little ballot into the machine and it counts it.
Exactly.
No, but like, what's the difference between that and online voting? We're still having a machine do the counting.
Yeah, but at least there are actually people there. There's somebody keeping an eye on things. I'm really not convinced about online voting. There, and people will be less convinced about it the first time that you uncover some kind of a scandal or some example of election fraud. It's not as secure, really. It's not. We've had so many examples of databases being hacked into and leaks and things like that. I cannot fathom why anyone would be willing to jump on this bandwagon and undermine our democratic process in such a fundamental way.
People seem to be pretty excited to undermine our democratic processes as it stands, so why not change the voting game too? But yeah, Michelle's right. We should absolutely revisit this on a slow news week. Guys, thank you for this. Let's move on to the next topic. Coming up after the break, BC Premier John Horgan has decided to pause a multi-million dollar plan to replace the Provincial Museum in Victoria. We'll share our thoughts. This is the Now News panel on AMI. Welcome back. It's the Now News panel on AMI. I'm Dave Brown alongside Juita Gupta and Michelle McQuigg. We've got one more topic to discuss. BC Premier John Horgan says he miscalculated public support for the government's plan to spend $789 million to replace the British Columbia Provincial Museum in Victoria. Horgan announced he's putting the project on hold indefinitely, saying he knew shortly after last month's announcement the public did not support the plan to replace the Royal Museum. We were having a little trouble loading the clip, so let's just say that John Horgan apologized and said he is wearing the mistake. Michelle, this is your topic. What stands out to you?
You just put your finger on what stands out to me. This is a premier with a majority government getting up there and saying, my bad, I had a bad idea, you guys aren't into it, I'm scrapping it as a result. Quick poll. When was the last time you remember anything like that happening before?
A straight up mea culpa like that? Oof, yeah. It's rare. Juita, does one come to mind for you?
Right? So that's kind of what jumped out to me. And I have to laugh and maybe ask you guys to sort of reel me in a little bit. Because I'm sitting here, I guess, with my journalism hat on going, wait a sec. Is it really that straightforward? Is it actually just a mea culpa? Or is there a more cynical reason at play here? Are there other political factors in the mix? Why is he doing this? And the very fact that you have to sort of ask these questions about what does on its face look like a very straightforward apology and may in fact be exactly what it seems is an interesting one to me. Apart from that aspect, that the whole notion of a politician taking ownership for a decision that they themselves are now describing as poor and pinning their own reaction on public reaction, which is itself is very interesting. It raises questions to me about the value of heritage projects. The way this was framed in the popular discourse was that they're saying we should not be spending this kind of money on a museum when we have other issues like a shortage of doctors, like climate change, very pressing climate change concerns, that it was being framed as kind of an either-or proposition, that the money that's earmarked for the hospital is being spent at the expense of these other extremely important issues that are of high importance to the public. I don't know how comfortable I am with that specific framing. And I do think that there's a conversation to be had about heritage projects generally and where governments play the role in those projects.
Mm. Yeah, we talked about this announcement when it was made last month. And the general consensus on the show was it seemed a little bit vanity-esque considering some of the very pressing economic issues. So, Michelle, maybe we bought into some of that discourse in the way we talked about it on the show in regards to housing, affordability, in terms of the healthcare system, et cetera, and $1 billion for what appears to be a vanity project. And admittedly, and John Horgan, the BC premier, he does represent a Vancouver Island riding not far from Victoria. So there's sort of that element to it as well. Is this something that's going to help the whole province? What's the value of this meet when it's right in your backyard? But Juita, yeah. Your reaction to the decision to cancel?
It was an interesting reaction and one that we don't often see from politicians, especially those at the head of majority governments. But really, he appeared to have very little choice in the matter. It was so evident that A, the government hadn't consulted with anybody, and B, just about everybody across the board, regardless of political leaning, was scoffing at this decision. You had the tourism people saying, what on earth are you doing? We've had this major pandemic. This is, you know, we're finally opening up and you're going to shutter the museum when, you know, we've been starved for tourist dollars. You had the opposition all over this, you know, just talking about the price tag, which was, of course, a really big, I think, a factor in the conversation. The government got pilloried because, as you both pointed out, there was a sense that they were spending a lot of money on this proposed museum rather than looking into financing other files. So really, it was one of those decisions where I don't think he had much of a choice because public opinion had so clearly swung in the opposite direction. Of course, with the opposition now saying that, you know, he's backpedaling, honestly, he can't win. So it is an interesting thing to see just because governments are so seldom seen to be as responsive to public priorities. Really, with the majority government, the last thing you want is a situation where the government sort of just bowls ahead and does whatever they want. So, yes, it is interesting in that it doesn't happen probably as often as we'd like, but it is nonetheless noteworthy because it shows that they're listening to what people are saying and are willing to take responsibility for that. And I think that is commendable.
We've only got 3 minutes left here on the clock, guys, and I do want to get to Michelle's comment in regards to the value of heritage buildings. Michelle, when you were away last 2 weeks ago, we were talking a little bit about the value or the way in which we want to tell more complete stories in regards to our history and where heritage buildings and heritage places can come into that. I think when we start talking about $800 million or $1 billion, I understand what you're saying in regards to say, hey, it's one pot or the other pot, and we know like these government spending pots are different. I think it's impossible to get away from big numbers like $800 million when maybe there are more holistic heritage operations you can do that better represent the entire province in localities, right? Regional localities.
Yeah, very fair points. And if you were to add all those up, you might be looking at comparable kinds of numbers. Yeah, I think there it's a good point you raise. It's obviously a much more complex and nuanced issue than we can tackle today in terms of how governments invest in heritage and the way it's perceived. I do find it interesting that heritage portfolios, that they're never, ever the glamour jobs. It's very common to have to see ministers, you know, holding one portfolio shuffled into heritage, and it's always called a demotion. So the way heritage type stuff is framed in government parlance, I find interesting and a bit troubling, but maybe it speaks more to what you were raising before. I wish I'd been able to be part of that conversation, because I do find that stuff really interesting. The other thing I will just note, though, in terms of this museum, it wasn't just a lick of paint and some new landscaping. This is a building that has a lot of asbestos in it.
Yeah.
We're talking about very serious structural issues. Funnily enough, I was having dinner last night with a friend who has a friend of hers who worked for the museum at one point. Apparently, there are all kinds of complexities around the organization as a whole, to say nothing of the physical infrastructure. So a very serious overhaul is planned here. I worry a little bit about the notion of pushing heritage, and along with that, arts and associated types of funding, and relegating it to a second tier in terms of the value that it's given in governments and by Canadians as a result.
I think that's another great evergreen question that we should use on a slow news week. But for now, that's all the time we have. Michelle, thank you for bringing that topic, and have a great weekend at work.
You too, Dave. Take care.
Joita Gupta, thank you for all your thoughts today, and you have an excellent weekend as well.
Thanks, you too.
That's Joita Gupta, the host of The Pulse on AMI Audio. Michelle McQuigg is the weekend news editor at the Canadian Press. What do you think of the BC government's decision to scrap that museum that we talked about on the show last month? Feedback at AMI.ca is the email address. At AMI Audio is where you find us on Twitter. 1-866-509-4545 is where you give us phone calls. Coming up after the break, Mike Ross has the regional news update, and Jeff Ryman will be here for a sports chat. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio, AMI TV, AMI.ca, and available on demand on the AMI Podcast Network. I'm Dave Brown. It's Friday, June the 24th, 2022. Coming up in the second hour of the show, entertainment critic Michael McNeely offers up a review of the film Wildhood, and AMI communications specialist Greg David will give you the scoop and look ahead to some of AMI TV's summer programming. Let's kick off the hour by handing things over to Mike Ross and the regional news updates.
Thank you, Dave. We'll begin in British Columbia. Today marks the one-year anniversary since the start of the historic heat dome that killed more than 600 people across British Columbia. Environment Canada's heat warnings covered most of the province, describing the heat dome as a strong ridge of high pressure, which trapped stagnant air like a lid over the province amid drought conditions. The anniversary comes just as the first hot spell of the year hits BC. Environment Canada issued special weather statements for most of the province earlier this week, with temperatures expected to rise to the low and mid-30s across the province starting today. Canada's top court is allowing a constitutional challenge to go ahead against a law authorizing the forcible treatment of involuntary psychiatric patients in British Columbia. The unanimous ruling follows a six-year battle by an advocacy group asserting a right to bring the challenge on behalf of psychiatric patients without the involvement of individuals directly affected by the law. It said public interest standing allows individuals and organizations to bring cases before the court, even though they are not directly involved in the matter and even though their own rights are not infringed. Chief Justice Richard Wagner wrote on behalf of the court that it can therefore play a pivotal role in litigation concerning the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, where issues may have a broad effect on society as a whole. To the prairies, an Alberta-based mail carrier says her costs for delivering packages along her rural route have doubled because of the steep hike in gas prices and cost of living. Jennifer Henson, one of 11,000 rural and suburban Canadian postal carriers, say she and her colleague are responsible for the fuel and maintenance costs of the vehicles they use. She says a subsidy from Canada Post through special tax treatment helps, but it isn't enough for today's inflation. She says those measures should be increased. In Ontario, Premier Doug Ford is set to introduce his new cabinet today, with one of the major questions being who will be health minister. Christine Elliott, who served as health minister through all 4 years of the previous Progressive Conservative government, did not run in this year's election. The next health minister will not only have to continue steering the province through COVID-19, but will also oversee billions of dollars in new hospital projects recently announced across the province. And to the Atlantic region, New Brunswick's Auditor General says the Crown Corporation that operates the province's liquor stores lacks accountability and transparency. Paul Martin, who also said the agency is not properly documenting its activities. In a report released yesterday, NB Liquor has no plan or strategy to develop the province's liquor industry beyond the broad purpose outlined in law. He says the corporation has no targets against which to regularly monitor or evaluate performance. And finally, low-income seniors on Prince Edward Island age 65 and older who are facing rising inflation can now apply for a one-time grocery card of $100. Registration will be accepted until August 26th. Social Development and Housing Minister Brad Trivers says seniors are often on a fixed income, and with the rising costs of fuel and food, they may be challenged to access healthy, nutritious food at local grocery stores. He says the new support, along with other programs, will help to ensure basic needs are met. And those are your top regional headlines going coast to coast across the country.
Thank you for this, Mike. Stay right there, though, because you've also got the big business story of the day. Mike, anybody who spent an evening out on the town will agree with this. Restaurants are back.
Yeah, they're bouncing back despite the inflation. You know, it was 7.7%, the most recent announcement from Stats Canada. It's crushing people. And yet, inflation, acute labor shortages, and the sort of the lingering effects of people sort of being cooped up, not to mention people starting to fear and certainly hear a lot more about a potential recession in the offing here, that places like restaurants and dining places, fast food, they're all rebounding above now their pre-pandemic levels. Mm-hmm. So the month of April showed that they were above their pre-pandemic levels for the first time. So it's pretty impressive to see these restaurants just overflowing. And why? Because people have been dining at home for, you know, almost 2 years, and they want to get out. They mm-hmm. want to experience mm-hmm. being out. Now, here's the one place that has not rebounded, and that's bars and drinking holes. They have not rebounded.
People, not if you've been to the corner of King and Bathurst on a weekend night.
Industry-wide.
Yeah, I know.
Industry-wide. But that sector has not rebounded at the same clip as restaurants have. And there seems to still be a little bit of a hesitancy, if you will,
yeah,
to jump fully back into the bar scene and the club scene, et cetera, et cetera.
I do think, Mike, sorry, not to interrupt you, but I do think that might have to do with the time frame of when the statistical snapshot was taken, because April was still sixth wavy, still thinking about Omicron, bars only just getting open. There were still some masking requirements. It wasn't quite the full bar scene. I think in a couple months' time, if we had this conversation again on a new StatsCan drop, I think it would suggest the bars are back.
Yeah, I think the other big thing is patio season, right?
Yeah.
So you get warm weather, people are just absolutely hankering to hit a patio somewhere, and the festival season starts up. Everybody starts hitting up their favorite patio and bar in the neighborhood or wherever they're heading. So this will get to that point. It will come back. But the fact is, with restaurants being among the first to drop mask mandates and to have the sort of all the restrictions, the infringements that were on them as far as occupancy and social distancing, et cetera, now they're back with a vengeance. And those numbers, not at all surprising mm-hmm. that people want to get out there. But what is surprising analysts is just given the cost of everything being higher, including restaurants, right?
Yeah.
The thing is, that's the one thing that surprises people here is restaurant costs have gone up too, but people seem to be willing to absorb that cost and have that experience above many others.
Well, I think there's also an inequality there. When we talk about some of those macroeconomic numbers, they don't impact people equally. We talked about that a little bit with David McDonald from the Center for Policy Alternatives yesterday, that there are certain individuals who are doing just fine in this economy, despite the rising prices, despite the rising cost of living expenses. So I do think that there are certainly people who are not doing this, but those who can definitely are. And we also know with the way the labor market is right now, where it's a very, very low unemployment number, that there's a lot of people who are going to be going out simply because they don't have time to cook for themselves. So I think there's some microeconomic factors that we can look at that go beyond some of the broader picture, the macroeconomic data.
Yeah, there's no doubt that, you know, as we move along through this, that I think that bloom will sort of come off the rose too. I mean, people will get their taste of going out to a restaurant and they haven't had it in a long time. But I also think that once the numbers start really impacting people, if they aren't already, and if the interest rates go up again, and we're hearing maybe 3 basis points for the next one, or 0.75 percentage point for the next one, being a potential rise. Things like that are also going to maybe push people back in to their homes and not necessarily being willing to go out to a restaurant twice a week or maybe cut back that dinner and a movie, maybe just do the movie, things like that, where right now it's almost a bit of a free for all because people have been cooped up. People want to get out if they can, but we'll see. I think once the numbers start rolling in a little bit later this summer, as you said, the bar scene is going to catch up. But I think that as these numbers, for inflation and for interest rates keep rising, I think we may see people start to watch those numbers maybe come back down a little bit.
100%. Mike, thank you for this.
You got it, Dave.
That's Mike Ross with the big business story of the day. Jeff Ryman is here for a sports chat. Jeff, let's start today where we finished yesterday. The NBA draft took place, and before we get to the Toronto Raptors, 4 Canadians taken across the 2 rounds last night.
Yeah, very impressive feat from a couple of Canadians going back to back, 6 and 7, Ben Mathurin and Shaedon Sharpe from Kentucky. So 2 Canadians going to the top 10, and then 2 Canadians being selected right off the bat in round number 2, and Andrew Nembhard and Caleb Houston, your guy from Michigan. So a great showing of Canadians so far in the draft, which is something of a trend we've been seeing the last, decade or so.
Ben Mathurin and Andrew Nembhard both going to Indiana. So, Jeff, is this a situation where a move over Memphis, Indiana is the new second Canadian team?
It could be. I love it. More Canadians equal more fun for myself, somebody who has been idolizing Canadian basketball for quite some time. But yeah, Indiana, they've got O'Shea Brissett as well, another Canadian already on their roster. So 3 Canadians total on the roster potentially come opening night. So it could be, sort of like how Gonzaga is in the NCAA. Maybe Indiana could be that for the NBA. But nonetheless, Dave, I love it. Like I said, more Canadians in the NBA equals more fun. And I believe I heard yesterday on one of the NBA draft shows that aside from the American players, Canada has the most international players on NBA
That's
roster.
Right.
So Canada
right.
is number two behind the U.S. in terms of international players in the NBA. So really, really impressive stuff. And honestly, we had four Canadians go yesterday in the NBA draft. In the next decade or so, Dave, honestly, that could really start to fill up, a lot quicker.
Yeah.
And we'll see more and more Canadians. Like, we could even see 10 Canadians go, in the next decade or so. It is really, really speeding up.
In the last decade, we went from maybe one or two players drafted to about 2 to 4 players drafted in any given NBA draft. So the development is certainly there. Now it's time to maybe qualify for an Olympics. Can we qualify for one Olympics, please?
And we're
maybe
there.
We got our soccer team to the World Cup. Can we please get our men's basketball team into the Olympics? Jeff, let's talk about the Toronto Raptors. They only had one pick. It was early in the second round. They drafted Christian Coloco from the University of Arizona. I think it's a really good pick, considering the team is very much lacking in terms of depth at the center position. He's 7'1". He's about 220. He was a really good shot blocker at Arizona. Still, the game is still a little bit raw, considering that he's 22 years old. But he only came to the game late as a result of Masai Ujiri's African basketball development projects. So this is an interesting connection point for Masai, the president of the team, doing his own player development in Africa and finding all kinds of players as a result, just like they did with OG Anunoby, just like they did with Pascal Siakam.
This is a Toronto Raptor pick if I've ever seen one. Like you mentioned, ties to basketball in Africa. I know Nick Nurse and the Toronto Raptors and obviously Masai Ujiri, very close with that. Nick Nurse says, hey, I've seen this guy a lot over the last couple of years. I've seen him develop. And like you mentioned, he came to basketball late. He started playing organized basketball at the age of 12. He's currently 22. In 10 years, he's developed that much. He's grown that much. He's 7'1", by the way. And so in the last 10 years, a huge amount of development. Now you add in a professional organization such as the Raptors, which are phenomenal in terms of growing prospects. Perfect fit. It really is. And if you look at the Toronto Raptors roster, there's no one over 6'9". On their squad.
They
needed size, they needed rebounding, and they needed a rim protector. I know they have Chris Boucher, who's a decent shot blocker and rim protector, but they need another body, especially somebody who's got a little bit of size and thickness to him. This is exactly what he brings. So love the pick. And again, it's a second rounder. The only pick the Raptors did have. We'll see how he develops. But again, like I mentioned yesterday, you got to believe in Masai Ujiri, Bobby Webster, and that Toronto Raptors front office and organization, because they've done such a good job of developing and taking it slow for a lot of guys. I don't know how quickly he will come into the rotation, but nonetheless, it sounds like a pretty solid fit for the Raptors.
There was an article on Sportsnet last night. Admittedly, they're one of the broadcast partners and actual owners of the team, so there's always a little bit of the propaganda feel to that. There was an expectation in that article that he is going to be into the rotation right away as the backup center. I don't know about that. When you draft a player at 22, there is some expectation they're going to be able to slot in faster than, say, drafting a 19-year-old or an 18-year-old. The game is still pretty raw, but he was the conference defensive player of the year in the Pac-12 last year. So he is a good player. Maybe it's only 4 or 5 minutes a game early in the season that blossoms by the end, but I don't know if he's immediate impact, but I still think it's a really, really good pick by the team. And as you say, totally on brand. Jeff, we've only got about 90 seconds here. Stanley Cup Finals, Game 5 tonight, back in Denver. The Colorado Avalanche having the opportunity to close out this series against the Lightning. Jeff, are we getting Game 6 on Sunday, or is it over tonight?
I think it's over tonight, Dave. I really do. The reason being is because they're in Colorado. That fan base, when that Blink 182 comes on, I'm telling you, it's sort of like steroids. It's PEDs for the Colorado Avalanche.
Make me feel
Avalanche
young
players.
Again when I hear all the small things, man. It takes me right back to being 15-year-old Dave Brown prowling the streets of NDG.
Great song. Love it. And I honestly think that Colorado is going to do it. It just because they looked really good towards the tail end of that game in Tampa. I thought they controlled the third period. They came out a little bit shaky early on in that last game, but they controlled the second half and that overtime period. Tampa Bay, I mean, John Cooper, like we were talking about the other day, almost sounded like he was defeated.
He reeled it in yesterday. He sort of backtracked a little bit.
It was probably a little bit emotional for him after the game, you know, last time out. But there's just something about it. I think that Colorado can do it. They have been the better team throughout the majority of this series. I'm not saying Tampa can't do it because we've seen them, you know, be in a hole before and sort of climb their way back. But if it's not tonight, Dave, it's got to be another night because I just don't see Tampa winning three in a row.
The series will end. That your comment, if it's not tonight, it's another night. Yes, the series indeed will end at some point.
Yeah, but I think Colorado does it tonight, especially at home. I just think they're going to do it.
I think at home matters too because of the quality of the ice. The quality of the ice in Tampa was terrible, and Colorado's a better skating team than Tampa Bay. The bad ice slowed them down. They are going to pound them tonight. Series over tonight. Dave Brown putting the prediction on it. Got my Dave stink all over it, if you know what I mean. Jeff, thank you for this.
Thanks, Dave.
That's Jeff Ryman. He's at the AMI Sports Desk. By the way, the Dave stink means that I will be putting money on said game totally legally. Single event sports wagering, legal in Ontario. Don't know if you've seen the commercials or not during the games. 8 p.m. Eastern Time, CBC and Sportsnet for that hockey game between the Avalanche and the Lightning. If you want the sports conversation to continue, you should tune in to the Neutral Zone today at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. The crew will speak with wheelchair racer Austin Smink. The Neutral Zone airs 4 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio every single Friday. You can find Grace Scofield at the AMI Weather Desk.
Thank you, Dave. Here is your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada. We'll start off in Cornerbrook, Newfoundland, where it is mainly cloudy, with a 40% chance of showers or drizzle this morning, and a high of 25 degrees. In Charlottetown, it's periods of rain ending this afternoon, then cloudy, with a high of 20 degrees. In St. John, showers ending near noon, then a mix of sun and cloud, with a high of 21 degrees. In Quebec City, cloudy, with a 40% chance of showers this morning, clearing near noon, and a high of 23 degrees. In Toronto, it's sunny, with a high of 28 degrees. In Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, a mix of sun and cloud with a 30% chance of showers and a risk of a thunderstorm this morning with a high of 29 degrees. In Brandon, Manitoba, mainly cloudy with 60% chance of showers or thunderstorms and a high of 23 degrees. In Regina, a mix of sun and cloud with a high of 24 degrees. In Lethbridge, Alberta, there's some increasing cloudiness this morning with some showers and a high of 12 degrees. In Red Deer, Alberta, it's mainly cloudy with 60% chance of showers and a high of 15 degrees. In Whitehorse, Yukon, a mix of sun and cloud with 40% chance of showers in the afternoon with a risk of a thunderstorm and a high of 21 degrees. In Kelowna, BC, it's mainly sunny today with a high of 25 degrees. And in Vancouver, BC, it's sunny today with a high of 22 degrees. And that was your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
Thank you very much, Grace. We'll talk to you a little bit later with some entertainment news. But coming up next, Michael McNeely will also talk a little entertainment when he offers up a review of the film Wildhood. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. It's a Friday edition of AMI at the Movies. Let's welcome into the show entertainment critic Michael McNeely, who's offering up a review of the 2021 drama film Wildhood. And Michael joins us from Kingston, Ontario. Hello, Michael.
Hello. How are you today, my dear friend?
I am well. I'm always happier when I get to talk to you. Michael, you caught this film at a film festival earlier this year. Why did you want to go back in time and review Wildhood?
Well, I think we were talking about the hill of representation that many LGBTQ characters have to climb in order to feel validated. I believe that this film is just yet another one of those examples of how important it is to reflect a different, I guess, lack of a better word, the different varieties of life that we all have on this planet.
So give me a little bit of context here. What is Wildhood about?
Wildhood is the story of two young men. Their names are Link, short for Lincoln, and his brother, Travis. So Lincoln and Travis are discovering that Lincoln's father has been lying about whether or not Lincoln's mother is dead or alive. And they want to set out on a quest to find out what happened to Lincoln's mother. And this is set in the McMahon Weather Reserve in Nova Scotia. And so these two young men really have a lot of obstacles against them because they come from an underprivileged environment that is rife with domestic abuse, especially from Lincoln's father. And they're not encouraged to find out information about Lincoln's mother.
Based on that answer, I think I know the answer to this question, but why is this film so important?
I think the film is so important because it's one of the very few films that we have in Canada that reflect true spirit, heritage, and culture, as well as one of the only few films that intersects Indigenous people and characters with queer characters and people.
So that's a couple of times this week that the expression two-spirit has been used on these airwaves, and we haven't really defined it. So, Michael, what does two-spirit mean?
I have a definition from the University of Toronto and the Canadian Association of Addiction and Mental Health, or the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, I should say. The definition goes, two-spirit refers to a person who identifies as having both masculine and a feminine spirit, and is used by some Indigenous people to describe their sexual, gender, and or spiritual identity. As an umbrella term, it may encompass same-sex attraction and a wide variety of gender variants, including people who may be described in Western culture as gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual, transgender, genderqueer, cross-dressers, or who have multiple gender identities. Two-spirit can also include relationships that would be considered poly. The creation of the term two-spirit is attributed to Elder Myra Laramie, who proposed its use during the third annual Intertribal Native American First Nations Gay and Lesbian American Conference held in Winnipeg in 1990.
So, Michael, thank you for laying that groundwork for us. It's important. Let's go back to the movie. What do you want to share about the stars of this film, Philip Lewitsky and Avery Winters Anthony?
I just want to share that the chemistry on screen was believable, that I really hope that Philip becomes the next Tom Cruise because he deserves it. He deserves his own Mission Impossible franchise. I know we don't really do a lot of service to Canadian actors because maybe they're not as well regarded or well known as American actors. But honestly, the talent that we have in this country is indescribable. And these two actors just nailed the chemistry of being brothers, of coming from an abusive household, of trying to find one of their mothers, and trying to stick together through trying times.
There's another actor involved in this, Joshua Ojik. How was his performance?
his performance also was spectacular. So just in case people are wondering, it's Philip and Joshua that play the two spirit individuals in this film, so they may also be two spirit themselves in real life. I'm not sure, I didn't search that far, but I hope so, because that would aid to the representative quality of their acting and their performance. I want to say that Joshua is a very good dancer, and you get to see that in the film. And I appreciated the experiences that I had of learning about the culture that these two men came from.
You had a chance to speak with Matt Sultan, who is the executive director of Reel Out, which is Kingston's queer film festival. They hosted a screening of Wildhood earlier this week. He recommended three other films about two-spirit culture. What are they?
Well, that's kind of a trick question, because he recommends this film. So it's two other films.
Oh.
He said to keep it simple, like his taste in men. I had to say that out loud, because he told me to. Matt Sultan is the reason why I got into film criticism in the first place, because I'm from Kingston, Ontario, and I was able to work with Matt for the Reel Out Film Festival since 2009. So I like to share his recommendations, or the recommendations of Reel Out. So in addition to Wildhood, there's the film called, I'm trying to remember what it's called, Fire Song, which is also on CBC. And finally, there's a documentary called Two Spirit. So all three of these films would be recommended to learn more about Two Spirit, folks.
Very good. Michael, once again, circling back to this film, Wildhood, were you able to find any critiques or criticisms from Two-Spirit reviewers who watched the film?
Yes, a friend of Matt's was able to talk to me about the film. Their name is B. Heeslip, and they said, "Hello, I did watch Wildhood when it was screened for Reel Out Film Festival. It was well done. I appreciate it. I think it getting nominated for the 2022 Canadian Screen Award for Best Picture was a big indicator of how much a great quality picture it was. I was really drawn to the dynamic between the brothers. The children are watching us and taking our cues on how to act and react to situations. I was fond of that, handling of that aspect of the story. So that B is talking about how we follow our elders, we follow our parents and our grandparents in terms of relating to each other. So let me continue here. I say I was drawn to the relationship shown between Link and Travis, even above the one shown between Padme and Link. Those are the lovers in the story. I felt it showcased a lot of our indigenous beliefs around taking care of the future generations and ensuring an equitable future of sovereignty for our children. And I could relate to Link and his rage. I think that is a common thread in indigenous stories, especially ones with trauma influence. Link had developed that hardness as a coping mechanism. I understood greatly the development of that mechanism in people. It made me feel sad about him, and I think it made him quite hardest. So I think, in all fairness, Dave, I have to take my criticism from B, because I agree with that 100%, and I do feel that this film is reflected on lived experience.
Along those lines, Michael, did you have any final thoughts you wanted to share on Wildhood?
Well, I just like to start working on getting these actors their own Mission Impossible franchise.
Oh, that's good stuff. Hey, Michael, thank you for this. Thank you for taking a closer look at this film. We appreciate it.
No problem. You can find it on Crave right now. It's free, and I believe it will be part of the CBC streaming platform. You can find Fire Song on CBC as well.
Right on. Hey, Michael, thank you for that. That's entertainment critic Michael McNeely with a review of the 2021 drama film Wildhood. As Michael mentioned, you could find it on Crave, or if you prefer to go with the rental route, The film is available for rent at tiff.net, T-I-F-F.net. Coming up after the break, we'll hang out with Grace and Nazreen and maybe say hello to Rumia too. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI, a Friday edition of the show. Let's bring in Grace Scofield to find out what's happening in the world of entertainment. Grace, one of the all-time great movie composers, is saying no more for me.
Yes, he is. John Williams is stepping away from composing music for film at the age of 90.
That's a good run.
Absolutely. It's the composer who brought you the music for Indiana Jones, Star Wars, Jurassic Park, Jaws, E.T., and so many other iconic cinematic scores. He'll be stepping away from film starting this year.
Do you have a favorite? You just fired off the list there. Is there one that you will always hear and it'll jump off the screen to you? I mean, we're listening to Indiana Jones right now.
We've got some Indiana Jones going. For me, though, nothing will invoke such an emotional reaction as the Jaws score. Mm. Where it's like, if you play it and I'm anywhere near a body of water, I am going the other way.
Yeah, okay. I vibe on the Jaws. I think that one's maybe even the most distinct of them all. The Star Wars one, though, also just has like that huge rising feel.
Yes.
But I think the moment in a movie where the score and the moment will always stick with me is Jurassic Park, the first time they see the dinosaurs. And the way that composition swells as they look out of the Jeep at the dinosaurs wandering through the field, that is such a visceral moment. And the music and the moment just match so perfectly.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that's fantastic about every single one of Williams' scores is that they're just so iconic. And, you know, it was the soundtrack to so many generations over the past decades, entertainment lives and entertainment interests. Yeah. You know, there's so many movies that have been... The scores have been composed by Williams. He has, let's see, it's 5 Oscars and 52 Academy Award nominations. His first cinematic score that he wrote was in 1958.
Oh my gosh.
So since 1958, John Williams has been influencing the content that we consume and what we see and what we hear. And yeah, I think that he just has so many of those moments that are just unforgettable in your mind when you watch some of these classic movies.
I'm not even sure if you had it in the list, but he also did Home Alone. He did Hook. Yep. So he did a lot of kids' movies in the 90s as well, which certainly reached through. Grace, who do you think is going to take up the mantle? I mean, it seems pretty obvious that it's Hans Zimmer.
Absolutely, it's Hans Zimmer. There's so many amazing composers composing for film right now. But I think that Hans Zimmer is, again, one of just those iconic composers that you hear in every up-and-coming kind of almost future classic
relationship with Chris Nolan and all those Batman movies certainly were a huge part of that. And doing stuff like Dune, for example, which was a really great movie last year. Now the call, what used to be, do we get John or do we get Han? Now we know the call's going straight to Han.
Absolutely.
It's going to be, they're popping some champagne in the Zimmer complex today. Hey, Grace, thank you for this.
Of course.
That's Grace Scofield with the Entertainment Report. Let's bring in Nazreen Abdel-Majid to find out what's trending. Nazreen, your story also comes from the world of music.
And we're doing a throwback today. So hashtag versus is trending because there was a live performance battle between Omarion and Mario. So they made its return last night with a 2000s R&B favorite. And Omarion is an R&B singer, actor, and dancer, but best known as the lead singer of the boy band B2K, if you know it. And Mario is also an R&B favorite in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. The battle featured Ray J and Bobby V, Sammy, and Pleasure P. Let me just give you a breakdown of this live performance because I watched this video. And Ray J was so off key while he sang his fan favorite, One Wish. And then Bobby V, Sammy, and Pleasure P joined forces to sing the song. And it kind of sounded on key. And that's where Ray J got mad on stage. because they were on key and they took over the stage. So Omarion and Mario's battle wasn't even any smoother if you thought it was going to be smoother. Mario repeated, he kept telling Omarion and his gang, including Jeremiah and Tank, that they sounded off key as well. I mean, the whole performance.
Your bird thinks you're currently off key, by the way.
There you go. Like, he agrees, actually. Yeah. So anyways, it was such a mess from the beginning to the end. I'm going to be honest. It sounded like a total sound check.
Yeah.
They weren't prepared.
Live R&B and hip hop is particularly difficult to do a technical setup for just because of the nature of some of the tonalities on the microphone, as well as the ways in which the beats can oftentimes peak sound barriers. You know this, you're a live performing mm-hmm. DJ. You know how tricky the sound setups can be if the PA systems aren't right, but it really shines through with R&B because the vocal caliber is so precise that it oftentimes requires just the right tune to make sure people don't sound flat or off key.
Oh, but it was.
Yeah, it was bad,
eh? It really was, yeah. But anyway, moving on from that, Mario, I know me and you used to jam to Mario back in the day. And
one song in particular, 2002's cover of Bismarcky's Just a Friend. Your heartbroken boy used to pump iron at the gym to that one. Oh, baby, you got what I need, but you say I'm just a friend, but you say I'm just a friend. Your boy was bench pressing to that one.
That was a hit. That was truly a hit. It was so good. Honestly, I was going to go for more of the OGs, Let Me Love You, and
Let Me Love You. I know that song. I remember that one.
Yeah. The other one was Crying Out For Me. No, How Do I Breathe?
No, I don't know that one either.
How Do I Breathe? Yeah, that was so good. But those are the types of songs that really felt dramatic back in the day. I don't know about you, but when I listened to the throwbacks, they were extra with their music videos, with their singing, with everything that comes in between. I liked Mario for sure.
Yeah. Well, back then recording was becoming more and more digital, but it wasn't as strictly digital as it is today. So folks like Mario were at least occasionally messing around with some instruments along the way. So there was a little bit more of that musical cadence and caliber to it, not to dismiss what's going on in R&B today, because some of it's really, really good. Hello, J. Cole. Yeah. It's certainly the game changed a little bit over the course of the last decade. But Nazreen, thank you for walking me down memory lane.
Of course.
That's Nazreen Abdelmajid with What's Trending. Let's bring in Ramya Amuthan to find out what's coming up on Kelly & Company today. Ramya, what do you think? Did you like my version of Mario more or Nazreen's version of Mario more?
Oh, you guys both sounded good. I think you should start collaborating.
Oh my gosh, that would be a collab that would blow them away. Oh yeah, you know, Drake and The Weeknd did something. No. Nazzy and Dave did something. Now we're really jamming. Ramya, what's coming up on the show today?
You did TikTok,
baby. Yeah.
I'm very excited for you.
Oh my gosh. What's coming up on the show today at 2 p.m. Eastern?
Okay, so on our app update, we're highlighting a couple of different things, including Samsung Pay no longer functioning on smartphones that are from other manufacturers other than Samsung. So John Mueller has the update on that and some other kind of disturbing things. Plus, we're talking about parks in British Columbia seeking ways to improve accessibility accommodations, and they're actually reaching directly out to the public for this. So Sylvie Paquette is going to tell us how we can get involved. Plus, we're talking about a new audiobook retailer, Dave, that is distributing reading materials via mail, digital downloads, all kinds of things. And they're right now present in over 20 countries. So Ryan Hui has the update on that.
Right on. Well, Ramya, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday.
Sounds good, Dave.
That's Ramya Amuthan, the co-host of Kelly & Company, coming your way 2 p.m. Eastern time on AMI Audio. Let's take a quick break. But after we return, AMI communications specialist Greg David will stop by and give you the scoop on AMI TV's summer programming. And in the meantime, I'm going to sing a couple Mario songs to myself. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Ooh.
Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. I am contemplating throwing away the rest of the script that is in my hand because I was just notified on social media that the classic 2000s teen drama The OC is now available on Amazon Prime Video in Canada. We may have to stop the show right now. I made it to go home and start watching this right away. This is very exciting news. And my weekend plans can now officially be canceled. But before I can get to my weekend, let's bring in Greg David for the scoop on what's going on around AMI. And Greg is a communications specialist for the company and joins us from Chelsea, Quebec on Saint-Jean-Baptiste Day. So happy Saint-Jean to you, Greg.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I report to Ontario's head office, so I don't actually get the day off today. But it was funny, you were talking about this earlier, and in this small town of Chelsea, we went through the downtown yesterday afternoon, and there was a big tractor trailer advertising fireworks.
Heck yeah. Did you pick up any?
No, but we're going out this afternoon, so maybe I'll pick some up. Do they still make the burning schoolhouse? Can I get that?
I don't know, but you're a law-abiding citizen, so I see how you can avoid these temptations of fireworks, fireworks displays in Quebec. Do you guys have dogs at your house?
No, we have a cat. We do have dogs in our neighborhood, though. Yeah, and that is the one unfortunate thing that everybody heads to social media and talks about how their dogs are not coping, which I totally understand.
Yeah, I get it, but maybe we can, like, give the dogs a safe room for like 20 minutes and give me a fireworks show. Cause you know,
right.
We gotta enjoy ourselves too. Dogs get to run around like sniffing stuff all day. Let's have 20 minutes for me. You know, I gotta be a little selfish. Greg, we're going to run out of time if I don't get down to business here. So let's jump ahead to AMI TV summer programming, including some new stuff dropping like Dish with Mary and Level Playing Field. We've got you covered, but there's also a new show coming down the pipeline called Mind Your Own Business. What's this one all about?
Yeah, it's hosted by entrepreneur Kevin Shaw, who is blind, and each episode of Mind Your Own Business is going to take viewers into the life of a small business owner who are also members of the disability community, and they're going to share their journey about how they got their business started, but more importantly, they want to speak to mentors about how to grow their businesses, and that's where Mind Your Own Business comes into play.
So tell me a bit more about Kevin Shaw.
Yeah, so like I said, he's the host. He's a member of the blind and partially sighted community, and AMI's worked with Kevin in the past, but he's also an entrepreneur. He founded MenuVox, which is a cell phone app that pushes restaurant menus to your phone to make them fully accessible. So no worries about, you know, going into a restaurant and not knowing what's on the menu. It's being pushed right to your phone. So yeah, he's got a lot of experience as a small business owner himself.
And give me just a taste here, Greg. Who are some of the small business owners that will meet in season one?
Yeah, so Amy Lockwood, she creates large chunky wooden... Yeah, she creates wooden toys for children that are fun and safe for children of all abilities. Her company is in Toronto and it's called Lockwood. Chris Stegas, he's a power wheelchair user who has created the Handy Cup, and it's a plastic cup that attaches to wheelchairs and is easily accessible, flipping the top if you have limited hand movement. And Serena Cormier and Natalie Shearer are two members of the blind and partially sighted community who run Two Canes Consulting, a consulting company out of Kingston, Ontario.
Oh, really cool. I know we've had Amy on the show before, and she was just a delight to speak with, Amy Lockwood. So really cool to see those businesses being profiled. So, Greg, here's the important question. When and where can we start catching Mind Your Own Business?
You can check out Mind Your Own Business when it debuts Wednesday, July the 6th at 8 p.m. Eastern. Again, of course, you can always stream it online at AMI.ca and the AMI TV app. But mark your calendars, Wednesday, July 6th at 8 p.m. Eastern on AMI TV.
Yeah, the on-demand side is always fun, but it's nice to catch the debut in real time with the rest of the world. You know, it's experiential viewing.
That's right. That's where we're going old school, where you got to tune in and watch the first episode on TV.
Yeah, and how are you going to live tweet at us if you're not watching it live? You know, that way exactly. It's more of a community thing. Greg, any other shows you want to put on the radar in regards to AMI TV's programming this summer?
Oh, sure. I mean, throughout the summer, we'll be talking about, you know, Level Playing Field, like you said, Dish with Mary. We've got something actually, I'm kind of breaking news. You're going to be doing something extra special fun that you don't know about yet, because I haven't sent you the email in support of the return of Dish with Mary. So that'll be coming soon. And lots of documentaries and episodes of our community coming in the summer that we'll speak to in the coming weeks.
I love getting those requests. Hopefully this one involves me shoving food in my face.
It does.
Oh, there we go. All right. You see, you guys finally know how to hit me.
me. Not just, hey, record a promo. It's like, no, shove this food in your face. All right, I can do that through and through. Hey, Greg, let's pick up on a thread the last time you and I were talking. We were looking ahead to the CBC's summer and fall TV schedule and talking about the importance of telling Canadian stories. And we didn't get a chance to explore it as thoroughly as I wanted to. So typically, the CBC was the place. It was the home of telling what were supposed to be Canadian stories. Do you feel like it's still the place and that the stories are still fitting that bill?
Yeah, I absolutely do. There have been, especially from an Indigenous storytelling angle, and of course, you were in Winnipeg earlier this week, talking about those types of issues and those real stories. And a show like Bones of Crows is coming up in the fall on CBC, and it's a five-part hour-long drama that's being told through the eyes of a Cree matriarch named Aline Spears as she survives Canada's residential school system to continue her family's generational fight in the face of systemic starvation, racism, and sexual abuse. And to be honest with you, Dave, unless you were watching a documentary or a feature film, I don't think you can get stories like this anywhere else. CBC is the place to go for stories, Indigenous storytelling, but also, you know, other Canadian stories as well are being told. There was a show called The Porter last season that was talking about Black porters on the Canadian trains and the stuff that they had to endure as they tried to start their first ever union. And so, yeah, I think that CBC is really the only place that you can find that kind of storytelling in Canada.
I think they've done a really nice job too in doing some contemporary storytelling as well. Places like Kim's Convenience were a show that encapsulated something that was Canadian. Homeland, although again that's it's more of an Alberta experience, but again you're capturing shows and experiences that are Canadian. And even to a certain extent, Schitt's Creek was a show that really focused something. It was quirky, it was different, but it maybe fit into that Canadian mold. We've seen the explosion of the caliber of Canadian TV, and the CBC really has been at the front of that.
Yeah, they have. And, you know, selling shows internationally, you know, you just mentioned Schitt's Creek, which wasn't, you know, it became a worldwide hit once it went to Netflix. And without CBC, it never would have been on the air. And the same thing with Kim's Convenience, you know, finding international coverage and internet, you know, being beloved around the world. No one would have known about it if it hadn't been for the CBC.
Greg, I think I know where we're going to land on this issue. Myself, as someone who worked for the company for a number of years and had a tremendously pleasant experience there, you as a TV fanatic yourself, we get these conversations around defunding the CBC, which I oftentimes find are, I'll call them misguided, but sometimes also had in bad faith. Where do you stand on those conversations as they're being had?
Yeah, I feel the same way that you do, Dave. I think that those that say that the CBC should be defunded, maybe basing those thoughts and comments on their political leanings and also on their beliefs. Because aside from their thoughts on how the news is being delivered and perhaps saying that, you know, whatever government is in power, the government-funded network is bad, CBC really is the only place that you can find Canadian stories being told in its primetime lineup. You know, you go to the other networks in Canada and, you know, you might find the odd medical drama or cop drama that's telling Canadian stories, but really CBC from top to bottom, when you're tuning into primetime, daytime programming for children, it's all Canadian content and it's telling our stories.
I believe the number is also around 7 million Canadians that would not have access to any TV or radio without the CBC. So there are parts of the country that get exclusively their journalism and entertainment through the CBC with a lack of proper TV infrastructure or the profit margins for a lot of companies to make the investment in the infrastructure of those places. Now that number I'm quoting you is maybe about 10 years old. Maybe that number's changed a little bit, but we're still talking about millions of people who rely upon the CBC.
Yeah, you're right. And it travels over to CBC Gem as well, the streaming service. It's available for free. And, you know, you may not have cable, but you know, a lot of people do have internet. So you always have access to those stories.
Greg, thank you for revisiting this with me. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks. Have a great weekend, Dave.
That's Greg David in Quebec. Happy Saint Jean-Baptiste to him, and hopefully some fireworks fire off. You have yourself a wonderful weekend. We'll be back on Monday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern time. Until then, I'm Dave Brown, reminding you to play safe, play fair, but don't forget to have some fun. It's Friday, so you know what that means. It's credit time.
Host Dave Brown. News director Mike Ross. Social media reporter Nisreen Abdelmajid. Sports reporter Jeff Ryman, audio technical producer and entertainment reporter Daniel Penamondo, descriptions by AMI's media accessibility team. TV technical producer Bruce McLarion, live production switcher Sebastian McKenzie, senior show producer Andrika Delanarol, producers Paul Daniel and Marianne Dion Jones, audio technical supervisor Paula Dineen, operations specialist Kyle Harper, manager of AMI Audio Andy Frank, director of TV production Kara Nye, vice president programming and production John Melville, president and CEO David Arrington. Give us your feedback at 1-866-509-4545. Copyright 2022 Accessible Media Inc.
An AMI original production.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.